Hi, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, and this is a Studio 2 Extra. Scott Bach thought his memoir was done. The book described his journey from small-town Michigan to a lucrative career on Wall Street, ending with the sale of his firm to a Japanese giant, the perfect coda.
I was literally dotting the last I and crossing the last T in September of 2023.
And then, chaos. At the time, Bach was board chair at his alma mater, the University of Pennsylvania. Over the next 2 months, Penn would be rocked by accusations of anti-Semitism, a donor revolt, and ultimately a snippet of congressional testimony that triggered the resignation of Penn's president and Bach's own sudden departure as board chair. That skirmish now looks like the first battle in an ongoing war over the future of higher ed. It was also a moment that sharpened Bach's critiques of modern finance, a world he knows very well and now views with growing alarm. All of this is chronicled in the final unplanned chapters of his book, Surviving Wall Street. Those chapters start with a campus event in September 2023, the Palestine Rights Literature Festival, and calls from some in the Penn community to cancel it. Penn does not stop the festival from happening, but does say something. Which is unusual, right?
It's very unusual. The president did speak out in pretty strong tones, condemning some of the speakers, but also restating the university's commitment to allowing controversial speakers to come to campus. And we actually looked back over time. We found the last time there was a preemptive memo put out by a president of Penn was all the way back when Louis Farrakhan came to campus, when Sheldon Hackney was president of the university. Decades ago, yes.
Why did that statement happen? Were people on campus calling out for it, students, faculty, staff, or was it basically because of discontent among board members?
I would say not even so much board members, but really, you know, a very small number of board members and donors.
They
were the ones. There was no pushing from students to speak out. There was even less from faculty. As a matter of fact, faculty were really on the other side of the issue, yeah. and they did speak out quickly. But, you know, the president's decision, which I certainly supported, was you know, kind of a compromise. I mean, there were people who really wanted a strong statement against these speakers. There were people who wanted to go further and prohibit the whole event from even happening, which really would have been unprecedented. And sort of the compromise solution was, you know, let's reaffirm our commitment to free speech, but let's also make clear we don't, you know, the university doesn't agree with some of these people. We understand that some of them have a track record of, you know, saying things that are inappropriate. And so that was the compromise.
The fact that a lot of donors wanted something to happen and that the university did act, maybe didn't act exactly the way they wanted to, but did do something. And I suppose we'll get into this more later. But what did that moment tell you?
That, you know, that moment, and here's where the story kind of gets more interesting, goes well beyond that festival or well beyond, you know, issues of anti-Semitism, is it pretty quickly became clear from the types of emails I was getting, literally by the hundreds, if not thousands, before things got going very much further, that there was a discontent underneath the surface, not just about free speech issues, but really even more so about, you know, things I would call, people identify as woke or DEI, or just left or liberal or what, you know, whatever word you want to use to describe the fact that, yes, universities do tend to lean left. It's always been the case. It was the case when I went to school 40 years ago.
Yep.
But there was an unhappiness about that. And now, I saw that early on. I wrote about that in my book. I said some things in the book about how this was sort of a battle for really the soul of the university. And I literally thought when I wrote those words only a few months ago that some people would read that and think, well, Scott, you're really exaggerating there.
I don't think they think that anymore.
I don't think so either, because now it's clear.
You make an important point. I think you could go back 30, 40, 50, 60 years and find that the student bodies at universities are generally to the left of the donor class. The question is, why does the donor class care now?
I think, look, the numbers, it's a little bit the story of my book about, you know, 40 years on Wall Street. I mean, the day I graduated, the Dow Jones was under 1,000. Today, it's over 40,000, okay? So it's gone up 40 times. You know, tremendous wealth has been created. Tremendous wealth has been given to elite universities. Places like Penn now have $20 billion endowments. Places like Harvard have much bigger ones. And so the schools probably to some extent become, you know, dependent on this money. I mean, it funds research, it funds financial aid, it's got all kinds of good purposes. And And I think for a long time, universities felt like this is just an unadulterated good. We are collecting funds we can use for good purposes. I don't think they expected that there was a notion that there'd be a quid pro quo for that. But they found out in this episode that there was a desire for a quid pro quo. And also, with all those donor dollars flowing to the university, if you look at boards of trustees of universities, they are pretty heavily weighted, not just toward donors, but I would even say toward Wall Street donors. Yeah. And look, I'm one of them, so I'm not here to sort of blacklist that.
But that's
that
why
crowd.
Your commentary is interesting. Yeah, like, yes, you've been in that world, and you are also, I think, issuing a bit of a warning about how much power and influence that group has over the modern university, or could have, when they flex their muscles.
I definitely am issuing a word of caution on that. And I feel like the interests of that group, I mean, you see it even recently in politics. I mean, the interests of that group are largely behind, you know, the status quo. They're behind, you know, globalization. They're behind open markets. They're behind stability, probably as much as anything. They like a high degree of certainty as to where the world's going. There are people who are uncomfortable with all that kind of, search for truth, search for ideas, you know, trying ideas, exploring things, whether you're a student, 19-year-old trying to figure it out, or whether you're a 40-year-old faculty member.
Okay, so going back to the timeline of exactly what happened, around the same time as this literature festival, there are a couple of disturbing incidents on campus. One, there's a swastika scrawled on a wall inside a university building. And then someone comes into the lobby of a Jewish cultural venue on campus and shouts some anti-Semitic epithets. First of all, in investigating these two incidents, was the university able to determine whether or not a member of the campus community was responsible for either of those?
I don't remember the specifics of what the association was between those incidents. I mean, the swastika, it was never discovered, like, who did that. It was kind of in an out-of-the-way place. It wasn't on sort of a big outdoor wall where you have, you know, lots of cameras and things. The fellow who came into Hillel and pushed over tables and shouted anti-Semitic things, I mean, I from what I was told, that was literally a case of, like, mental illness. Like, this fellow was, you know, a bit, you know, deranged, if you want to maybe use a word that I don't know how appropriate that is, but, you know, there are issues like that. So, you know, look, these were really, really unfortunate incidents that came at a terrible time. They were rapidly and strongly condemned by university leadership. But, you know, unfortunately, even one or two incidents like that sort of amp up the anxiety.
But no one knows if the person who walked into the Hillel, the Jewish Cultural Center, was associated with the campus community or not.
I don't recall that. I think he had some association, but he wasn't like a sophomore, you know, English major. I mean, it wasn't something like that. It was someone who'd kind of around campus, maybe part time or something like that. And someone who had a history, somewhat of a troubled history.
Got it. Okay, so I think it's important to establish at this point in the timeline that there is discontent brewing, but the detractors sort of mobilize, and it doesn't really get them anywhere in terms of getting rid of you, getting rid of President Liz McGill. It seems there's like a letter circulating. Almost none of the trustees sign it. At that point, it feels like a blip to you. It's sort of like something that's sort of flares up and goes away.
I mean, it felt, I would say, you know, look, let's say there's a date that's really important in here as well, which is October 7. Yeah. I would say leading up to October 7, before we had any idea that terrorist attack was going to take place. And even frankly, for the several weeks after, it felt like, okay, this is the most contentious situation I have seen in that Board of Trustees in the nearly 20 years I've been on that Board of Trustees.
So it felt significant.
It felt very significant, but it felt like we would get through it and kind of get to the other side without really fundamental changes to the university. And that's, you know, I want to add one thing to those. I was talking about the couple of unfortunate anti-Semitic incidents that occurred there. You know, one thing that as a leader you try to walk a pretty fine line is, you know, the more you sort of, you know, the more one side gets aggressive and loud, every action creates a counteraction,
right.
You know, and if you like shut down speech, you're very likely to get more of the speech you don't want.
Yep.
You know, if you crack down, and it kind of goes back and forth. I mean, the statement on the original Palestine Rights Festival that was being done, you know, the President McGill put out, not only was not fully satisfying to the people who didn't like that festival, but it made people on the other side very angry.
Yep.
And I sometimes wonder whether some of these anti-Semitic incidents come because people want to stir up trouble.
Yep.
People who don't like the fact that donors are in there trying to stir up, you know, opposition to a speaker they want to hear. And I'm not saying their actions that are all appropriate. I don't agree with that for a second, and we condemn that every single time. I'm just saying part of the reason that Penn historically has had quite a lenient approach to protests. I mean, I've been there for a long time, and we had all kinds of protests on fossil fuel investments and, you know, local real estate issues and many other things. We were pretty restrained because we felt like they're going to play out. There are a small number of people involved, and, you know, eventually they'll move on. And
you're going to fuel the fire by making a statement,
exactly,
taking an action.
Yes.
And actually, I wanted to ask you about that. Generally speaking, do you think universities should issue statements on global events, on political events? Penn rarely does it, but Penn does do it sometimes.
Well, and Penn and many, many others have now said they're not going to do it anymore. I mean, that's become quite in vogue to say that. I mean, it's a fairly new phenomenon, I think. But you know what I actually think it's tied to? I think students today have mental health, and I don't mean that in sort of a dark sense, but just, you know, they feel pressures, they feel strain, they feel anxiety. And so I think there's more kind of, you know, things said in soothing, comforting terms to them. So,
yep,
the, you know, when you have the pandemic, it's like
you think
that.
That's a good thing. I mean,
I think it's a troublesome thing. I think it's a Pandora's box, because as soon as you speak out about, you know, even something as horrific as the murder of George Floyd, you know, then there's expectations for the next thing that comes,
yep,
along. And maybe it's not as bad as that. Maybe it's worse. Maybe it's just different. And so you get into this rut of having to sort of speak out on almost everything, and you end up doing it in a way that it almost can't satisfy, you know, whoever the constituency is that you're trying to address. So it's a troublesome thing. But I know a lot of universities, including Penn, have said we're not going to do it anymore. But I wonder how much that will hold. I mean,
unfortunately, we'll see the next event.
Yeah,
and we don't know what horrors it will unleash and what type of emotion it will unleash. But
I mean, the example I've given is, you know, if you're head of a school in downtown New York the day after 9/11 happens, you're not going to say anything. You know, if you're a school that's, you know, got a huge Jewish population and October 7 happens, you're not going to say anything. I don't know how realistic that's going to be when those very emotional, tragic moments come. But I certainly understand why they're trying to get out of that business.
You note that the school issued a statement after the horrific October 7th attacks. And did so more quickly than it did after George Floyd's murder, which leads to the question of the folks who are critical of Penn's response there. What did they actually want? Do you think you understand what they wanted you to do after October 7th?
I think somebody might have wordsmithed the document slightly differently, I suppose. But I do struggle a bit with that. I mean, the reason I didn't happen to know off the top of my head how quickly the statement about George Floyd came out or exactly what it said. But there seems to develop this notion. And again, I think it's very political. I think people are sort of anti-diversity, anti-woke, et cetera. They have the sense of, boy, when there's an issue that involves blacks or an issue that involves LGBT, I mean, people are, you know, bending over backwards to try to, you know, do everything possibly they can to comfort those people, to protect those people. And so it was just really surprising after hearing that so many times. I looked back at that George Floyd memo, and it was 2 days slower to come out than the October 7 one. And it was really fascinating. It didn't say he was killed, and it didn't mention the police.
No. So October 7th happens. Obviously, there's a statement by the university. There are student protests on all sorts of sides happening, as there are all over the country. Early December, President Liz McGill is summoned before the House Education and Workforce Committee, along with a pair of other college presidents. So 5 hours and 15 minutes into this testimony, Elise Stefanik, who is a representative, poses a hypothetical.
Does calling for the genocide of Jews violate Penn's rules or code of conduct? Yes or no?
In my mind, that's a factual question about what the code of conduct at Penn says. Is it not? Am I misunderstanding or misremembering?
No, I think a lot of people misremember that, but I think it really, it was a legal question. It was, if this set of facts occurred, is this, you know, essentially, is this a violation to the point where you could, say, kick someone out of school, suspend right. somebody or something? Yes.
And my understanding is that what McGill said is that it would depend.
It is a context-dependent decision.
Because speech in and of itself does not violate the code of conduct at Penn, which draws that part of its code of conduct really from the ideas of the First Amendment. Am I right here? Am I on the right track?
That's right. The code of conduct, which had been in place for many, many years, was explicit that students could not be disciplined for speech alone.
That raises the question. What should McGill have said in that moment? Do her detractors, did they tell you, they feel she should have lied?
I think I wouldn't, for myself, use the word lied, but I wish in retrospect, and I think she wishes as well, that given a highly political question, right, that the best answer would have been a highly political answer, which...
A different type of dodge?
To be honest, yes. I think more of a different type of dodge. I mean, that, you know, it would be hard to say that speech alone, whatever the context... can violate a code of conduct that explicitly says the speech alone is not subject for discipline. So
the only thing that I can think of that a member of the Penn community might have asked for as a remedy is change the code of conduct so that speech in and of itself is punishable. Did anyone ever ask you for that?
Look, in the 18 years or so I was on that board, I didn't hear a single student, faculty member, donor, alumni, or trustee say that we should tighten up our code of student conduct when it comes to speech.
Even after the testimony?
I mean, after it, there was... The problem is it's a real hornet's nest to start digging around in there because, you know, what is hate speech? I mean, the reason, frankly... You know, going back to the whole free speech issue that some trustees very early on were sort of troubled by. I mean, the recent history of debates about free speech on campus are about whether conservatives are allowed to speak there.
Sure.
And there are people who think some of what those people say is a form of hate speech. There's not a big appetite, even after this,
yep.
for people to say, let's try to rewrite the
So
student
all they
code
really
of conduct.
Wanted then was for her to dodge the question. I mean, that's the only conclusion I can come to, is that what they wanted not was to change the code of conduct, not was to make speech punishable, speech and speech alone punishable, but very simply for her to have done a better job not answering the question.
I think the many would have liked to just almost sweep this under the rug
right.
by simply saying, I mean, if you'd been able to get in more than about five words without getting shouted down by the congressmen who were there,
yeah.
what you might have wanted to say, what a lot of people would have liked to say, is to repeat for the 15th time in that hearing that you condemn all forms of anti-Semitism. Secondly, to say that you have never heard anyone on your campus call for the genocide of Jews. But thirdly, to say that if someone did, I think that would by definition be a form of bullying or harassment that would go beyond pure speech and be maybe the single example, maybe the only example out there of the student code of conduct being triggered by pure words. Now, that does fly in the face of what the actual document says,
yeah.
But that's, people would have been happier had that kind of been swept under the rug.
Basically, they wanted her to get through it.
Yes.
And they wanted her to lie a little bit to get through it. And she did not do that in that moment. And that leads me to the question of, you know, is that not what you want in a leader? Someone who refuses to engage in falsehoods, even in the toughest moments, just to wriggle out of a situation? I mean, that's what I think people say they want in leaders. Maybe they just don't. I don't know.
Well, I think here's I can raise an additional fact that I think is somewhat interesting. I do think the entire hearing was a setup. I think they were looking for the gotcha moment. I don't think it's an accident that they called down three presidents who were all brand new. Liz McGill was the longest serving of the three at about 17 months. The other two were less than a year. You know, some people pointed out they're all women. I think that's, you know, that's something worth reflecting on as well. But to me, maybe even the combination of being not only women, but being really new to their jobs. Now, yeah. What does that mean? That means maybe you don't have quite the backing of your community, your trustees, your alumni.
If you can get them to fall into the trap, as you said, or the setup, that then that could trigger a reaction on campus among the donors, among the board, that leads to their dismissal, which gives you a win.
That's right.
After the hearing on Capitol Hill, you impress upon McGill that there's no future for her at this school. She should step down. Then you resign yourself. There is an alternative scenario where you say, I shouldn't say the word, but screw this. You guys want us? Come get us. We're standing on our principles. Why didn't you want to take that path?
Yes, there was that opportunity, particularly because the statutes, the charter of the University of Pennsylvania is quite awkward to remove somebody. I mean, you've got to call a public meeting, you've got to have debate, et cetera. It would have been very difficult to remove the chair or the president. It just felt to me that the situation was untenable and that the board was unmanageable, and therefore the right thing to do was for her to step away. Now, many people have asked them, why did you also have to do that? I mean, in part, I wanted to speak out. I wanted to give her, frankly, and I did it that very night, that Saturday night, more of a positive and I think fair send-off than the board itself would have been comfortable doing at that moment. They were in too much turmoil themselves to think about that. So I thought, you know what, rather than stay here and be trapped as part of the organization, I want to be free to speak out. And what I think is not a radical left-wing sort of thing. I'm not, you know, uber woke. I'm not even sure what really all that means. But am I in favor of diversity? Yes. Am I in favor of universities continuing to do all the great research they've done to try to extend lives and make, you know, everybody's life better? Yes. Am I for more access for people whose parents can't afford the high price of tuition? 100%.
You write in the book that this harrowing saga would further illustrate how the influence of Wall Street had mushroomed since I first arrived there in the 1980s. How did what happened at Penn at the end of your tenure speak to changes on Wall Street and the people and the worldview of the people who run Wall Street?
I think, again, it's a question of scale, that the wealth created on Wall Street, which was very modest pre-1980, call it. I mean, the 70s was kind of a lost decade. And, you know, as I say in my book, when I graduated from Wharton, I did not know what an investment banker was. I mean, it was a very small field back in 1981 when I graduated. It became huge. And, you know, people in that realm, they have a view that almost everything should be calculated in terms of dollars and cents, in terms of value, in terms of return on investment and things like that. And I think academia doesn't really fit that model that well. And so if you try to force it into something like, you know, sort of why are students studying poetry? What kind of job is that going to get them? Yeah. You know, it's funny how one of the misconceptions that clearly arose in this whole thing is that students in general are sort of pretty radical, pretty activist. I mean, frankly, I wish they were a little more politically attuned. I mean, most of them, a vast majority, are very, very focused on getting a job at a place like Wall Street or maybe consulting or someplace that's actually pretty aligned with Wall Street.
I understand the idea that the donors and the board members who come from the Wall Street world might see things in terms of dollars and cents, but I also wonder if they see things in terms of winning and losing, conquest and surrender, dominance or subservience, that sort of binary that you have to win. That felt like it was pulsing under the surface of this somehow.
I think that is a very good observation. I think there, you know, there's control. You know, there's a desire to just, you know, kind of amass more wealth, control more things, you know, control politics, control sports, control universities. You know, there's a bit of a notion, and I don't want to throw the whole private equity world under the bus because I think it's done some very positive things. But, you know, one of the precepts of the private equity world is that almost any business model can be made better if you bring the right people to bear and you rethink it and you try to really drive it to maximize value for investors. I think it's great when that's applied to, you know, fat corporations that have right. a lot of excess cost. I don't think that's great when it's applied to a university yeah. and trying to boil it down to almost like a trade school thing, you know.
When it comes to elite colleges and universities today, do donors and trustees have too much power and influence? And if so, what could be done to change that?
I think schools should look to have more diverse boards of trustees, and I don't mean that although it's still valid, I think, to pursue the kinds of diversity we've talked about in recent years, you know, racial and gender and things like that. But I think more diversity in terms of what people do and where they come from. Yep. They may not have as much money. They may not be able to make $1 million or 10 or 100 or $1 billion. Donation in the course of their lives. But I think the schools need to put a little bit less emphasis on how much money we bring in donations and a little more on how can we govern this place in a way that brings a lot of different perspectives to the table so that we don't kind of overreact to any particular event that comes along. I see you walking across the campus, cool
professor studying romances. How am I supposed to pretend? That was Scott Bock, former board chair at the University of Pennsylvania. His book is titled Surviving Wall Street. Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Marie Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Al Banks engineered this podcast episode. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Thank you so much for joining me.